The point of Free Lunch, the newsletter and column, is to be a sort of guide to the economics debate that's out there, a guide both to the kind of intellectual and academic debate and the policy debate that comes out of it. And that's why these sorts of events that we do irregularly are really an attempt to do the same thing as the column and newsletter does live. So today we are very fortunate to have one of the world's great economists with us for an hour for a conversation about economics and policy as it is informed by economics. I'll make an effort to keep quite a lot of time free at the end for questions. We will end at 2 p.m. sharp. So let's just get going. We'll start with a conversation here on stage, and at some point we'll open up to questions from you. The whole session is recorded, and there will be a podcast of the whole thing for people who are not here today and will want to listen, so just be aware that we are on the record. I think Professor Heckman isn't, well, he won't be offended if I say that he's not a household name in the general public, but he's very much, or I would say more than a household name, among economists and public policy specialists. Professor Heckman got the Nobel Memorial Prize for Economic Science in 2000 for, you know, economist work, formal technical work in econometrics. Just to read you the citation, it was for his contributions to theory and methods for analyzing selective samples, econometric theory. My own first encounter with Heckman's work was in graduate school, and it had nothing to do with the public policy stuff we'll talk mostly about today. It was the Heckett estimator, named after Heckman, a technique for precisely come up with econometric analyses of samples where there is a sample selection, where you don't get a random selection of observations. In the public policy community, the substantive content of where Professor Heckman has applied his methods is fantastically important. I think in most countries today, it's taken almost as axiomatic that there is a strong public interest in the very early years of childhood development. That wasn't always the case, and I think the appreciation of the importance of early childhood interventions and the impact of those on adult life outcomes build to a very, very large extent on the work and the findings that Professor Heckman and his colleagues have provided, including at the center he directs at Chicago, the Center for, it's a wonderfully expansive name, the Center for the Economics of Human Development. All of this is linked, but perhaps not in obvious ways, to the grand debate of the day, which is about inequality and social mobility and whether things have worsened over the last decades and what, if so, to do about it. That's a debate that is a political big topic, economically a big topic, and it's also leading or powering a lot of the electoral insurrections we're seeing both in this country, in Europe, and in the US, and we might get to that. But because the work and the reach of your work is so broad, I'd like to start a little bit at the beginning. The Nobel was for very formal work, econometric theory. The public policy community knows your substantive work, in particular on the effect of early childhood conditions on adult life outcomes. Could you just give us a sense of your intellectual trajectory? How does the formal side connect with the substantive side? Where did you come from, and where have you ended up?
Well, if you read the rest of the citation, you'd see that they talked about the work on evaluating public policies. And that's been a recurrent theme through most of my work in the last 40 years, since I really been out of graduate school, 45 years or so. And one of the big issues that I've worked on, one of the recurrent issues I've worked on, is the economics of skills. I mean, partly it's a topic that is central to the work at the University of Chicago, human capital theory, going back to Schultz and Gary Becker, and continuing, I would say, on today through the work of the Center for the Economics of Human Development. And so understanding skills and their importance, and understanding human capital and its multiple manifestations and the development of human capital, I think has been a theme throughout my entire life. I wrote my thesis on a version of this question, And so even though it's true that recognition for some of these items comes in a kind of spotty way, nobody wants to know about a trajectory, and I don't blame them for not wanting to know about the trajectory. But the trajectory really started with trying to understand some very basic questions about what are useful strategies for promoting human achievement, like success in the labor market in particular. I mean, anybody who looks at the data, like the OECD report on rising inequality, will recognize that skill prices have played the central role in explaining the rise in inequality in most OECD countries over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, the changing skill price. It hasn't been employment as much as skill prices. And that's for male skill prices and female skill prices. That's the lion's share. That's true in disaggregated. So skills are playing a huge role. Now, of course, skill prices are still different from skills. But we know now that the economy is dividing between the skilled and the non-skilled. And in fact, the haves and the have-nots are a big part of that story. So I think the human capital aspect of this has been appreciated fully. But my own interest really started with understanding what were effective policies and what were not effective. I worked a lot on civil rights issues, looking at things like Title VII and finding out that they had a huge effect, actually, on promoting the advance of Southern blacks in the 1960s. But you can't help but be impressed by the importance of education. I mean, in the case of the black Americans, in the 1920s and 30s, there was just exclusion from public schools. And once black Americans started gaining access to education, there was real economic progress. And that was not the whole story, but an important part of the story. Skill prices for blacks were also an important part of the story. So I would say it's a recurrent theme. So I see it much more as a continuity. So it just happens that certain pieces have been noted by certain people under certain cases. And that's fine. You know, it's the way life is as an academic. But I think that the continuity has always been on understanding skills. And most recently, before I got into the work on childhood development, I did a lot of work on job training programs, or what sometimes called active labor market programs. Did a lot of research on this, primary research, ran some experiments, looked at studies, reviewed the literature, tried to replicate some of the literature, and there was a persistent finding from a lot of the programs in the United States and also in other countries around the world. The job market training programs, the labor market programs for disadvantaged youth in particular, but also for disadvantaged adult males anyway, were not that effective. And I found that to be a very, very pessimistic conclusion, that really there wasn't much we could do. And then about the time in the mid-90s when Herrnstein and Murray were writing their book on the bell curve, which is a very popular book, I mean, Murray came to Chicago quite frequently. We talked quite frequently. You'll see I'm acknowledged in the book. I was very intrigued by what Murray was finding, which was that armed forces qualifying test, his measure of ability, was playing a pretty important role in explaining a lot of behavioral outcomes.
So this was a quite controversial book. That
quite controversial book, right.
Inequality in part two.
Exactly, IQ, but it played a very important role, I think, in terms of just the scholarship on the subject. What he did for the first time, don't forget that psychologists frequently have been making these measures up independently of any predictive power. You have IQ, you have achievement tests. How are these tests validated? They're basically validated with respect to each other. What most economists are interested in is how these things predict real-world outcomes, employment, wages, and criminal activity, and a number of other things. So I thought, to his credit, Herrnstein and Murray, linked these tests to real-world behavior that we're interested in. But they came up in the end of their book with a hereditarian view. It was straight eugenics. It could have been very comfortably read in Britain in 1890, maybe, or 1900. It was very much a hereditarian view. And so out of that, and out of looking my own discouragement with the findings from the job training studies, they weren't effective, I started asking, well, is there any possibility of changing or affecting the lives of disadvantaged people? Maybe it is a class. Maybe it is just genetic reproduction. I mean, one version still very much believes that genetics are all-powerful and that the genetic component, even though that's not as commonly stated in the public discussion for a variety of reasons, there's still a very powerful belief in that. So I started looking around, and I came across some interventions. And actually, I actually went to a seminar. It was with my wife, who's here, Lynn. We went to a seminar, which was by, just on a whim, more or less, by a neurosurgeon at Wayne State University. He was speaking downtown at a group called the Erickson Institute at Chicago. And I don't know why we went. But he was talking about the importance of the early life years on the formation of the brain. And he had some amazingly interesting slides showing, actually, that there was some neuroeconomic basis of how early life conditions were shaping the brain. I got very interested in this. It was just, as somebody outside this field seeing this. And it was at the same time, so I saw that, well, maybe there was some work. And then I became aware of these early intervention programs, the Perry Preschool Program, the Abecedarian Program, a variety of high-quality interventions, which had affected the skills in a way that these adult training programs were not affecting the skills.
So these are at 3-4 years of age? Is that?
Some of them go back to even starting at birth. Some of them start even before birth. You're talking about interventions that actually informing the mother not to drink and smoke and to do certain kinds of activity. So there are interventions that start with the child, yes, at birth sometimes. But certainly the preschool, which has received the most attention, is like ages 3 and 4. But I would argue that the early years before that are also important. So what happened is I started looking at this body of evidence, and I was very curious about it. It offered to me some opportunity. Maybe there was an avenue of avoiding this kind of genetic determinism, this hereditarian notion about how fate was determined. And so I got interested in this, and I pursued this systematically. And that brought me into a whole range of questions. So in some sense, you could say, well, maybe I was just being a dilettante, I'm just pursuing. But I view it as a continuity of the work that I thought about on human capital. So here's an example. In the 1960s and 70s, when the human capital model was first proposed, there was a lot of feeling, and in fact, in the development in psychology, and in fact, it still influences education schools today, so-called cognitive psychology. What became commonplace was the notion that IQ was a very important determinant, cognition, measured by an IQ test. And it even gave rise in economics to a kind of a strange theory, which I think has been discredited, the so-called signaling hypothesis, which said basically that schooling had no impact, that all it was signaling your ability. So that was a theory in which the notion of human achievement was sort of boiled down to one measure of ability, and that's all school was doing was certifying that ability.
So you're born the way you are, and then if you get into a good school,
you get into a good school. But it was inefficient to signal this ability for employers. So you go to, so that theory has more or less been discarded. It's no longer. But what was interesting about it was based on this one-dimensional conception of what human beings are, namely IQ, namely just cognition. And then as I got in and into this area, I realized there's something richer here, and it's not just the measurement that these early training programs can do something, but you ask, how did they actually work? What's the mechanism through which they work? And they work through promoting things that were kind of off the discussion starting in the late 1960s and 70s, were very much on the table in the U.S. common schools 150 years before, namely in the common school, Horace Mann and the so-called McGuffey Reader. They were talking about what sometimes are called character skills or personality skills or social and emotional skills or sometimes less felicitously the non-cognitive skills. And what I began to realize in the course of this enterprise was that there was a rich set of challenges that came for the economist to understanding skill formation, the process of skill formation, and measuring what was effective and what wasn't. So that was a continuity. It was a career continuity. But now we thought of much richer measurements, not just looking at test scores as usually conceived, but looking at a variety of measures about behaviors. And then when we follow people over the life cycle, as we did, in the Perry study, which we're actually actively still following. I went from a reader of the study to now, and I'm looking, we have collected a sample of people. The Perry children are now 55 years old.
And they started at birth?
Yes. The randomized trial started like in 1964. No, they're starting at age 3, these. The ABC is another program that was starting started about 10 years later in chronological time, but it started at birth. We have these two large studies. And so I've played with these as kind of examples, laboratories, if you will, for thinking about how these programs got to be as effective as they are and what the mechanisms were in particular. And what was interesting about it to me was that it broadened the economist's notion of skill much beyond the idea of just test scores, for example, which had been the notion, and it still is used. Mm-hmm. People still hear. I mean, you said you were with Jeff Sachs. I was with him in Seoul last year at the World Education Forum, and he was going on and saying, the performance of the Chinese or the Koreans was partly because of their high PISA test score, signified what they learned. But OECD itself has actually come to question whether or not the PISA scores are sufficient for really describing human achievement, even schooling achievement. And so in a paper that I did for the OECD, and we can certainly make it available to you if you want, we're now talking about inventories of non-cognitive and social-emotional skills. And so OECD itself, the very creators of the PISA test, are changing their standard. They're at least modifying it to account for this broader notion of skill. Now, you see, what's interesting about this, I think, is not that this is such a profound idea. I mean, if you go back, I can quote Horace Mann, who was a famous educator who founded the Common School movement in the U.S., or at least he's attributed with doing so. And he was writing like 170 years ago. He was writing about the Common School. And he said, the least of what we teach is reading, writing, and arithmetic. The secret lessons, you know, are things to do with character, with the ability to stay on task, to interact with each other. And those were essentially what were monitored skills back in the early days, reviewed as something that was a product of the school. And then in some sense what happens, and this is the danger of academics in some sense, you know, you specialize, you get into certain categories, and that common sense notion gradually got pushed away. Mm. And the notion that things like grades or teachers' ratings and these other broader inventories of human achievement could no longer be trusted because there might be bias. You know, you take a test that's not biased. A teacher assessment or a grade might be biased. Turns out that those teacher assessments and grades are very highly predictive of what goes on in the adult workforce. And it's things that, so these are commonplace lessons that we forgot, we as a society forgot, in the name of progress. So, you know, under the guise of cognitive psychology, we outsmarted ourselves and focused completely on IQ and achievement tests and so forth. That led to the craziness in the US of the No Child Left Behind policy. And now we're backing away from it. So it's this multiplicity of skills. That's commonsensical. Everybody knows this is important. At an intuitive level, this does not shock anybody.
One thing that comes out of that is actually a link between methodology and substance, which is that if you learn how to measure something new, you tend to focus on that. It sounds a bit like that's what happened.
And, well, it is.
You know, there's sort of a lamplight and looking for the key. Issue.
Well, it was partly that, but it was also partly the fact that some of these other skills, you might call, were shaded too quickly into what other people thought were preferences, or they thought were the proper zone of the family life. Mm-hmm. And so if you started encouraging sort of perseverance or staying on task, or for that matter, being far-sighted, you were partly shaping preferences. And in truth, there's a real legitimate question about whether or not some of these policies are not, in fact, shaping preferences. And that leads to this big barrier, which leads to a big boundary. People are saying, well, you shouldn't be engaged in that. Not only should the parents be engaged in doing that, not the state or any other organization, but it also should be that there are some things which are preferences and some things which are skills. That's fairly sharp.
So this is a sort of a challenge from a liberal point of view in the classical
sense. But a lot of people.
One interesting preference is time preference, patience.
Exactly. Right? So time preference we know is highly valued. If you look at measures in the labor market, people who are patient, not only do they acquire more goods, they save, they're prudent in certain ways, but it also turns out they're highly valued in organizations. You study the value of the time preference and patience, and you can actually see from wage equations, from studies on this. And so that's a skill that's highly valued, but it's also a preference.
And can it be taught?
Yes, it can be taught. And that's the part that's interesting. But it's not taught in a way like you'd have a special class on time preference today. I mean, no, there is. There's a danger. There really is a danger. And in fact, I'm an academic, and I shouldn't attack academics. But I think a lot of times what happens is you get so focused on a certain thing that just becomes your obsession. So whether it's IQ or whether it's time preference here, as we're talking about, or conscientiousness or any particular set of characteristics, that we typically think, well, maybe here's a skill out there, and then maybe we have a curriculum for that skill. So what we've learned about it is, again, a common sense lesson. See, I mean, none of this is profound. I would bet the primates, if you could properly sample them, would have actually said what I'm about to say. which is the value of parenting, the early primates, I mean, not just us that today, but but what I mean is that if you think about what the successful ingredient would be of any of these successful programs, it's really a kind of a form of parenting. It's mentoring, staying with the child. And I would even argue that these successful adolescent programs, not all early childhood, looking at what a successful mentoring or a program is or a training program, there are successful versions of these. And those programs actually have a huge mentoring component. Mm-hmm. And that's parenting. I think that's just age-adjusted parenting. And so again, it's a common sense, a lot of common sense ideas here. And they'll say, well, why do I, you need, I've seen you, I've developed a cough here at the worst possible time, but anyway.
I'll let you cough while asking a question.
Okay. But the common sense got somehow, we got educated out of common sense. Oh, thank you. Very good. Yeah, this may help. This is a Swiss, I don't know if you ever take these. Yeah.
They're very good.
They are good. They work well. Anyway, so the point is that these common sense ideas kind of got, and I can see why they got kind of edited out of the public discourse. Partly there was a notion of bias in grades. There was a notion that somehow these things about values were viewed as somehow much more the zone of the parent, and we should not, public education should get nowhere near touching these things about these social and emotional skills. But I think as we understand what successful lives, how they're formed and how people can succeed in societies, and I'm talking about all kinds of societies, that there is a pretty wide agreement, you know, that it's not a good thing to be so violent that you can't control your emotions. It's not a good thing to be stupid. You know, there are a lot of traits which are valued, and I think universally valued without putting cultural or religious association.
Now, trying to contrast that, I think, with some of the themes in these big questions about inequality, because the main theme here, there's so much to pick up on, but the main theme is that skill differences matter a lot for income and other measures of success in adult life.
Other things matter, there's no question.
And that these things are amenable to policy. Yeah. That's probably the theme we hear the least about in the public discourse on inequality, mobility. What we do hear more about, the sort of loudest noises, if you like, are about trade and globalization. They are about a rigged political system. They're about technological change. Now, all of those concerns, the people who are concerned about those things, are they just barking up the wrong tree, or how does it fit?
No, I mean, there's definitely, I mean, skill prices are determining the value of skills, obviously.
So skill prices are just what the market reward you get for being relatively
skilled. So we have seen a broad trend that's been well documented for decades about skill bias, technical change. That's a component of
it. So that's increasing.
That's increasing.
Is that true around the world? Is that an American finding?
It's not just uniquely American. It's found even in less developed countries. Mm-hmm. There is a general skill bias. You see it even now in China, where you're getting a mismatch between the FDIs coming in wanting the technology and the labor force that's out there. It's still, even though they claim there's a glut of Chinese college graduates, there's certainly no glut of Chinese apprentices and middle-level skilled people. There's no glut. In fact, there's a real shortage. So skills are really important. And we know that technologies, they adapt to the local environments. So the same technology, a technology, say, from Germany that's transported over to China will be adapted towards a lower skill price, which is there, unskilled labor. But what you'll find, though, is that there's still a big shift in demand for skills. And that's I think, a universal ingredient.
Now, there's one
story. Skills being a vector of skills, though, not a single skill. We're not talking just highly educated people. We're talking about people who have the capacities to perform independent judgments, who can respond, who are resilient. That's one of the big issues now, is how adaptable societies are to change. And part of that is flexibility. So some of these non-cognitive skills I'm talking about embody resilience, the capacity to be open to experience and then to adjust to it, to adapt, to learn from failure and then move on.
So this is a skill in a sense that allows people to change careers, change work, change tasks over the course of their lives.
I think flexibility, obviously the world is changing rapidly. That's so trite, I hate to say it, but it's true. But the question is the adaptability to that change is what's really critical.
On that particular question, do we kind of have to give up on the people who are too old to acquire that? How late in life can that skill be acquired?
Well, there's an unpleasant fact that the older you are, the harder, I mean, as a fact, just biologically, I mean, it's been documented, even when you start teaching people new computer programs, that the older the person, the slower the learning, as a rule. It really is. Obviously, smart people are old and dumb people who are old, but there's a distribution. But there is a sense that, no, it's not too old, but many people, in some cases, it's not too late to learn. I mean, there's neurogenesis goes on even in the late 80s and 90s. That's been documented by some of my colleagues at Chicago. And, so there's definitely still learning, but at a slower pace.
Because the reason why I want to push you on this is that my sense and what you hear is that, that there are a lot of, among a lot of the angry people out there here and in the U.S., a lot of them are precisely the people who feel like they don't fit into this new sort of economy where adaptability is at such a premium. So
but
do you have a message for them that isn't a message of despair, I guess?
Well, but I think you don't want to have a message of false hope. And I think this, we've actually experimented with this in the U.S. And that is, and this is showing up in the U.S. Presidential race. It's going to show up even more. Everybody has always been saying job training programs ever since Lyndon Johnson was president. Yeah, it's been kind of a key phrase for both Republicans and Democrats, actually. Democrats started these actively the way we think about them today, at the scale we think about them today. But the fact of the matter is when these programs have been offered on a voluntary basis, older workers have typically not participated in those programs for two reasons. One, it's more difficult to learn. I'm not talking about older 45, 50-year-old steel workers. They have a shorter horizon to recoup any investment, so they say, well, is this going to be a good investment for me to make? That's one. And secondly, the learning curve. It's harder. It's harder to learn a lot of new skills. So we had a company in Chicago, Motorola. It had a new technology incorporated. It basically involved a new IT system for the company. So it basically offered individuals the opportunity to take a training course to operate this new IT system. These were sort of middle-level people in the organization, or to retire, or take some bonus payments and retire. And it turned out there was a very sharp age gradient. The older the people were, and generally they took the benefit. They didn't see the benefit of taking the training, and the horizon was too short for them to actually gain this. So there is a sense in which on the fewer economics of this, that the idea of retraining everybody, which is, I think, that was the fallacy, I think, of the war on poverty in the 1960s. And this is where I think the new economics of skill formation comes along. There used to be the idea that people were perfectly malleable and that somebody who was like 3 years old and somebody who was 73 years old more or less could acquire the same skill. And the programs that Johnson targeted were across the board. They were across the board. Now, what we've come to understand is the dynamics of skill formation, that the earlier years, you're more malleable. That's, again, common sense. I mean, that's embodied in a lot of wisdom. And the older you get, the harder it is to change, the less resilient you are. And so in that sense, I think what we have understood is that certain age-adapted policies or skill level or adapted policies are appropriate. And that would be that at the age 45, 50, 60, the idea of retraining somebody. It sounds like a good thing. You send them back to college. It sounds like but as an economic investment, it's probably a pretty poor idea. You might say, well, their skill levels are low. Something like the earned income tax credit or wage subsidies might be a more humanitarian and economically efficient way to attach them to the workforce. So you don't want to throw people away, but that's the brutal truth of it. See, the one thing about early childhood you were mentioning that's very interesting is that the early childhood argument, for me as an economist, was very unique in the sense that it had two features which are not common when you talk about skill and, for that matter, inequality policies. And that was that it was economically efficient. We computed economic rates of return of 7 to 10% per annum on the old Perry study. And in the newer study, when we count the health benefits, we're getting 13 to 14% per annum, which is quite a high economic benefit. And that's including tax costs. It's including all of the costs.
And that's for interventions at which age, sorry?
This last intervention I mentioned is starting at age zero and going through age five. So those are very substantial interventions.
Yes.
So that's a true proper accounting. We're talking about the social rate of return. So it counts the excess, the burden of the taxation. It counts the welfare cost of taxation. This, I think, would survive any rigorous study by a good economist about what the rate of return would be. So that's economically efficient.
We should be throwing money into this.
Well, I'm just saying it does pay off. I don't know how many programs there are in Britain or around the world that have returns 7, 10, 13% per annum. But the other part of it, you see, is in the inequality argument, you frequently hear about equity versus efficiency. Mm-hmm. And so there's always a zero-sum argument, right? That somehow we're in the business of saying, well, we want to take from the rich and redistribute to the poor. And that's the mentality that has dominated a lot of the discussion, that somehow there's the 1% and then the 99%. And it's in a politics of redistribution. And here, I think what we're talking about is more a politics or an economics of pre-distribution, or at least I realize pre-distribution is used in multiple senses. Maybe I should use the word early distribution. Because the early investments not only promote reduction of inequality and enhance social mobility, they're highly efficient from an economic standpoint. And that's an unusual thing. So it's not a zero-sum game. It's not like you're taxing the rich to pay for the poor. It's not just this redistributional policy. There's scope for that policy. I'm not denying it. But it's not the whole story. And I think
dare we say free lunch?
Well, close to it. There's still transactions. I don't like the phrase free lunch. It's, My former colleague Milton Friedman would roll over in his grave if I fully accepted that phrase. There are costs, but it's close to a free lunch. And compared to most public policies, this is not just a question of throwing money away or just giving it. So the traditional Western policy is alms to the poor, right? I mean, you see that in the Bible. You see that enshrined in a lot of the welfare state policies. Here, what you're talking about is building skills and at the same time promoting social mobility. So it does reduce inequality. That's the part. But it's down the road. That's the other part of the problem. It's not going to be selling you. It's not going to help somebody's re-election campaign in 4 years. It's going to help the country in maybe 20 years or 15 years. And that's the hard sale. I mean, it's become increasingly harder in public policy discussions to make these long-term investments. But we have made those long-term investments, at least in the U.S. The prime example in the U.S. is we launched the Transcontinental Railroad, you know, during the Civil War. I mean, that was an Abraham Lincoln initiative. So people, and you know, power plants and things like this, huge economic return. But it wasn't, certainly Lincoln didn't realize the benefits of the Transcontinental Railroad. I don't think it was even finished until 5 years after his death or so, four or five years. So the point is that with a long-term perspective, which I think should be taken, this will reduce inequality. But then it's the hard sell about the short-term benefits.
But for it to reduce inequality, you have to focus it on the disadvantaged children today, I assume. If you give it to everyone,
talking about inequality generally.
14% per year.
No, I'm just saying this is one policy.
Right.
I don't want to be caught in the position of saying this is the only thing we should do.
Sure.
And especially when people think about this notion about, is it only the early years? No, I mean, some people even suggested just invest in the early years and forget about anything else. There's a complementarity over the whole life cycle. So early years should be followed by good years of education. But skills are undeniably important. They're a part of the story. And they've been overlooked, I think. Like the Piketty book, for example, human capital just gets a footnote. It's not even considered part of the longer-term strategy. Never mind the other questions about the book. It just doesn't receive so much attention. Tony Atkinson's new book on inequality is a very good book. But it has a very useful discussion about redistributional policies in the traditional welfare state.
Right.
And he mentions, briefly, these notions about skill enhancement policies. But it hasn't been the central focus of a lot of the studies.
So those approaches take human capital differences and inequalities as given. Is that a fair way of putting it?
They don't frequently look at all the incentive possibilities about how you might promote skills in the long run. There hasn't been this long-run focus on skill formation to the extent that I think is efficient. Everybody talks about education. I mean, all world organizations, all economists talk about it. But what I'm talking about is thinking a broader view about education. Education, really, it's not even education. I would say it's enhanced parenting, starting before schools normally begin, and then maybe continuing after school. When you think about apprenticeship programs, you think about programs that adapt people in the early years, in the 20s, and in their 20s and early 30s, for example, on the workforce.
I want to open up to questions, but just one quick question at the end. You just now, I think, publishing a paper comparing Denmark and the U.S.
Yes,
and social mobility in the two in the two countries. It's a really interesting comparison, probably because Scandinavia has this sort of image as being a model. It came up, I think, in the race between Clinton and Sanders.
Sanders is a big enthusiast.
Tell us about that paper.
Well, the title of the paper is The Scandinavian Fantasy, and it starts with a quote from the Washington Post of 2 years ago, and it says something like, the American dream is now lived in Scandinavia, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so Sanders, in particular, has popularized this. Clinton has as well, and many people have noticed the Scandinavian welfare state is very, very generous. And in fact, advocates for early childhood are the ones who are most frequently pointing to Denmark. Because there's near universal pre-K, there's near universal schooling, there's no tuition. This is one of Bernie Sanders' proposals, right, to have free college tuition. And so what we did is we looked at the determinants of social mobility, comparing Denmark and the U.S. And what we found is that pre-tax income mobility in the U.S. and Denmark is about the same, pre-tax. But not surprising,
mobility here being
in income, just the mobility between the father's income,
is related to
and the child's
income, right?
Income, the next generation. Exactly, that's the measure that's called the internet IGE. It's the relationship that Alan Krueger recently popularized under the name of the Gatsby curve, the Great Gatsby curve, after the F. Scott Fitzgerald book. And so this relationship, pre-tax and pre-transfer, is more or less the same. So it's kind of the skill transferring. But of course, after taxes and transfers, what you're finding is that Scandinavian intergenerational mobility is much higher. There's much less dependence, but that's the tax and transfer. That's the kind of Atkinson story, and that's a valid story. But now the question becomes, what if you look at educational intergenerational mobility, the relationship between the education of the child and the education of the parents? What's that relationship? How does that differ? Or how much the family income gradients affect that relationship about the education of the child? And surprisingly, we found that those relationships were almost identical for education, for educational outcomes in Scandinavia, at least in Denmark and in the United States. So that's quite interesting. Then we started looking more deeply. What does the Scandinavian welfare state do? It definitely compresses test scores. The bottom tail of the Scandinavian, there's a huge problem that comes from comparing countries internationally, trying to come up with an appropriate living standard. And so in every paper that tries to do this, it's got to be subject to real scrutiny. We try to be careful. We go a number of ways to try to make real living standard comparisons. But nonetheless, there's no question there may be some issue. But what you see is that the test score distributions in Denmark at the bottom of the distribution, the bottom of the socioeconomic scale, are much more favorable, much fewer people, much higher test scores among the disadvantaged children than in the U.S. No question about it, that this system of free education is having a role. But then you ask, how does that translate into earnings? The answer is it doesn't very well, precisely because of the welfare state. There's a taxation. And so if you look at the disincentives to acquire skills that are built in as part of the redistributional system, you see that on the one hand, it encourages the formation of these skills. And then in the end, it discourages it by putting very high taxes and very high subsidies. So we actually document that during the course of the study that we were doing, during the course of the time period we studied, there were certain programs that subsidized the wages of high school dropouts or secondary school dropouts in Denmark. And you could see a dropping off in the schooling rate of children doing that. So even though they had higher test scores, why go to school? Why take the extra effort? You can immediately cash out. You can get those benefits. So the question then becomes a much more subtle issue. It's not just a question of expanding early childhood. It's a question of actually trying to get the incentives right. So so Scandinavia encourages these skills and then discourages them later in life. It's creating test scores. But another part of the story is that these test scores that they've encouraged are mostly cognitive test scores, and they really haven't. And there are other aspects going on in Scandinavia. There's still an awful lot of sorting going on by neighborhood districts, family income districts. Schools are heavily restricted in terms of input. So there's a lot of neighborhood sorting, which does affect the outcomes of the children. So that's.
I want to open up to questions. I'm sure there are some. I have more, but let's see if somebody wants to ask the first question. There are mics coming around. So the gentleman here, let's start there.
Yeah, politicians are beginning to talk about a living wage, which means it's probably already overdue. And we have, I would say, not increasing permanent unemployment, but increasing leisure time, because that's what automation creates. And we've started calling it unemployment. Really, it's leisure time. How do we educate a generation of children where many of them, a significant percentage, are growing up to never work and still add value to society?
And you're saying they're growing up to never work because automation will...
Yeah, because there will be no jobs, which is a good thing, because we're aiming towards 100% unemployment. That's the goal, surely.
Well, you're Shades of Keynes, you know, the old essay. You got to be careful about it. I'm not sure I accept your premise. So I think what I should argue is say, well, let me take your premise as granted for a second, and then maybe come back to the premise about whether or not we're moving into an age of full automation and full leisure. But especially in the world that you're describing, these kinds of social and emotional skills, the ability to read, to do more comprehensive activities, to engage in the larger society, will, if anything, be more important, right? So if you really have this leisured class that you're talking about, these people who really are free of burden, then those people themselves will have to think about structuring richer, fuller lives, more flourishing lives. And I would argue exactly that these kinds of skills that we're talking about will play a fundamental role in shaping them. But I'm not so sure about the automation. I mean, I know that's hotly debated, but I think without a lot of evidence, right? You think it's so sharp that we're going to be at 100% unemployment and enjoying this leisure bonus?
But just to follow up on this, there are two possible challenges, right? One is the idle rich, the owners of the robots, if you like, and then possibly there are the poor who can't find jobs, or at least not at a wage that sustains their any acceptable lifestyle.
Well, but you see, I mean, this has been discussed, at least in my lifetime as an economist, for literally for decades. This was a big issue in the early 60s. Right. People were talking about the automation boom and that we were going to be putting people out of jobs and but the only point is that the economy adapts. As long as the economy is allowed to adapt. I mean, think of the huge growth in the service sector and think of the huge growth in the kind of possibilities that are out there for doing other kinds of activities. Even if we thought about charity work or going to NGOs or doing this, there's a huge sector out there. There's a huge demand. I mean, it's not like we have accomplished every task we need to accomplish and everything is done. So even if the rote routine work is out of the way, there's still plenty of challenges. And I would argue that the challenges will be more to think about creativity, we haven't cured all disease. We've certainly not cured all disease. We've hardly explored outer space. We've hardly really made energy-efficient solutions. So there are a lot of challenges that are out there. And I think the challenges we're talking about involve these combinations of skills, not just being smart, but being perseverant, staying with the task, building new industries, thinking about, you know, staying the course to actually create these new
opportunities. You said Shades of Keynes. Yeah, there are Shades of Marx, I think. Yeah. Scientist in the morning, fisherman in the afternoon, a literary critic, and maybe an economist in the evening.
I would bet still people will be pretty heavily specialized, right? I would guess. And I would think there would be plenty of jobs to do. It's just that for example, I'm not sure that I have a job. I mean it.
You're not sure you have a job?
Well, no, I enjoy it. So, I mean, is it a job? So there's, I think, I imagine if I were like the man with a hoe in Belgium, you know, 140 years ago, that was a real job. I mean, I've had manual labor jobs, you know. I've actually worked on ranches and I've had cattle kick me and so forth. That's a job. But actually working on what I enjoy, that's not a job. I shouldn't say that. My dean is here. He'll cut my wages. But quite seriously, I think, I think that the structure of employment has changed and the tasks with it change. I just don't see a shortage of tasks that will come along.
I hear more Shades of Marx, creating yourself through your autonomous work. There's another question down here.
It could be autonomous, but it could be there's also the social enterprise, right? So there is a Marxian, could be a Marxian component, yes.
Please.
Yes.
So did you both have your hands up?
Because then me.
Okay, yeah.
No. I actually like that first line of questioning, because I'm actually more concerned not so much at the phenomenon of automation, but the rate of change that we are exhibiting at the moment.
Yes.
I mean, there's obviously guys like Ray Kurzweil in the U.S. who are talking about like this accelerating and accelerating up to a certain singularity point. My question to you is really, how would you define a skill level then? Because effectively, the way I think about it, you know, at least try to think about it, is that any low-skill level job, such as a waiter, a bartender, you know, anybody who does anything remotely sort of manual labor-wise type of thing, would be eliminated with the robots. Any low-skill level jobs, so, or even people who are highly educated, but they're doing an intermediary sort of type of job which is not creative, such as yours, for example. I mean, yours is a creative job. I'm talking about like people who are actually, okay. I'll give you an example, financial services. Anybody who does anything within the financial sector, unless they're in a creative type of capability, I think those type of jobs will probably disappear down the line. So my question to you is, again, back to the gentleman's first question is, how would you actually define the early schooling educational level for kids so that you actually steer them into more creative type of jobs and more sort of jobs that are not going to be threatened by automation? Because there's 100% certainty in my mind that all types of non-creative jobs will be under pressure in the foreseeable future. We're talking in the next 2 or 3 decades at most.
No, I agree with you. The pace is increasing, the pace of change. But see, partly this gets at the definition of skill, and it partially gets at the notion that so some skills that we now know and measure are extremely important to adapt to change. This is kind of openness to experience, the ability to experiment, to create, to learn. Those can be trained. Those can be taught. So that creates a more flexible human being who can respond to a new environment instead of somebody narrowly trained. Now, I think the 19th century image of somebody trained, you know, to be an accountant or to be a miner or a horseshoe repairer or something of the sort, that is gone, I think, and that should go in terms of it. So, but we can train people to be adaptable, and I think that's what you're talking about. But then there's a second notion that comes along, and that's the notion of skill itself. The notion of skill is relative to the available technology. And so what's happening, and this is a whole question about measurement of skill, we're so used to thinking about skill as kind of measured by a paper and pencil test, and we think about academic skills, for example. But that's increasingly being abandoned. What we're actually looking at is skills that are useful in performing tasks. And so there's a dynamics. Our very framework for thinking about skills evolves as the skills themselves evolve. So there are new tasks, and I think we can measure that task. And then the challenge to the educational system will be to adapt the students to what maybe some of those new skills or increasingly important skills would be. So I think that there really is some scope. I don't think we're stuck necessarily. Just imagine how people would have thought about the available technologies. I mean, look, von Neumann was a genius, really. He developed the digital computer, the hardware for the digital computer, and the kind of basic programming, did game theory. But, you know, he had no idea of a personal computer. He had no idea. Just imagine if he looked at a Samsung today, he'd be stunned what the Manhattan Project was doing with, you know, they were solving differential equations with hand calculators. Mm-hmm. You can do in seconds on a Samsung calculator, and that's not a big deal. So I think that what happens is as we build these new ideas, we think of new possibilities. And I think that's what we underrate. So yes, but the only thing that we want to make sure is that people are flexible enough to adapt to that, so they're not narrowly trained. And that's exactly where I'm thinking of a much broader view of education. We think of education as essentially not just coping, not just learning a trade, not just learning this. It's not like an apprenticeship system where I learn only to fix a certain type of Volkswagen engine or something, in which I actually go out and I think more broadly about how I can change, adapt, come up with new ideas, and land on my feet when I'm, and part of that's a social emotional trait, learning from failure. Part of this adaptation is actually failing at it, and almost all success stories are stories about individuals' failures, right? They fail, and then they learn from the failure, but they stay with it. And so I think that's the essence of what's, I think, of what will probably be, we should receive even more emphasis, but doesn't in a lot of the kind of current accounting in educational systems. So that's why I think I agree with you, change is important. I'm not sure I'm as radical as Kurzweil in thinking of how radical the change will be at the point of singularity. I don't know if the computers are going to take over the earth, like Hawking and others are saying. I think we're still going to be taking over the computers for quite a while, since we still manage them and can shut them down. Maybe we'll get a 2001 Space Odyssey, but you all know how that ended. And we did win in that one, too. So.
Let's take a few more questions. So I think you had a question, you had your hand up, and on the back row, let's take those two first.
It's interesting that you're giving the talk here in the UK, because I think the history and the current notion of what's normal education and what the state pays for, which age, is a little bit different from the US.
Yes.
But I think your point that, you know, I think you're a little overselling how hard it is to say this is a big investment to move education lower, right? We already pay for public childhood school from age 4 to 18 for everybody, and nobody sees that as anything other than a required investment. So to say we just have to move down a year or up a year or change the focus seems to be a little less complicated hurdle to get over than to say we have to reinvent and make a huge investment like the Transcontinental Railroad. I don't see it as that big of a difference.
Well, let's get the second question right away.
I was just going to go back to the gentleman's point over there. I think we have to be very careful about what we think as being low-skilled or undervalued or less-valued jobs, and we can go backwards as well as forwards to look at this. You don't have to go back many decades to find the top footballers in this country living on subsistence wages. They're now earning millions of pounds a year. Now, that's a huge change. You don't have to go back very far to find, you could count on one hand probably the number of famous chefs in the world. Now we have hundreds of chefs who are superstars. We have Heston Blumenthal, who is, and Noma Radecki, who, sorry, I probably got his name wrong, for the Noma guy, who are now blending cooking with science. Bartenders, the bartenders may actually be the next superstars in the world. I mean, this is happening already, and I think we have to be very careful about pigeonholing existing lower-valued so-called jobs with right. what they may turn into in the future. And as we get more leisure, more and more things that we currently think of as being routine, I mean, most sports people in the entire world, including all the athletes, all the rugby players, all the cricket players, and probably I'm not familiar with American sports too, these people were very poorly paid, and now they're enormously paid. This change is already with us, and we can see it in action.
Yeah, that's partly a wealth effect, the demand for variety. And it's also, I mean, so I think that is a much more affluent society demanding this kinds of leisure activity. So that's, I think that's a natural consequence of economic growth. But the kind of economic growth you're describing is actually one that creates a bigger pie. And so we can spend it in creative ways and actually would create new tasks and new occupations and demands for old tasks and refining what the football, but also the media. The fact that the media now allows for television royalties that were not present, I imagine, in rugby 100 years ago, right? You can go online now and watch a rugby game and there's a big market for that. It's not, that wasn't there. So there is that aspect of, but let me come back to this question. When I was talking about the difficulty, I was talking more about a political difficulty. But I would disagree with the premise of your story. The early childhood education. See, the word education I don't like. Sounds like I should love it because I'm an educator, but I don't. Because when we get into this area, what we're really talking about is a different kind of interaction between the child and whoever the teacher is or the mentor or the early child care worker. It's involving, you know, when you're talking with a 2 and 3-year-old, talking about interacting, it's more like a form of parenting. It's more like a chance of interacting with the kid. Play. Play is an important, but play is not an, should be, I would argue, more of an integral part in elementary school. That involves a changing focus about what the nature of education is. So it's not like just adding an extra grade. It's changing qualitatively what goes on and understand. But see, I would argue we probably want to change education systems that way. So instead of going your direction, I would say we probably want third graders to involve more play and interplay, to involve more personalized education. And that's where I think education will go, that you can get to the position of being able to track individual children. And to stay, tracking sounds like, you know, there's a blimp over the city and you're tracking where these kids are going. I don't mean that kind of objective, that kind of 30,000 foot or 10,000 foot objective. What I really mean is something more like a sort of what some of the child psychologists would call scaffolding. So it's a little like you're building a sculpture, you scaffold. And so scaffolding entails my interacting with the child. Suppose you're a 3-year-old, you exhibit certain behaviors. I respond, but I respond to you differently than I respond to this other 3-year-old. I think that's part of where the bonus maybe of our society's wealth can go if we do really have this fabled leisure you're talking about. But also I think that that involves a fundamentally different type of education or schooling. And with it, there's some political resistance, especially when you get to the values of saying stay with the task and do certain things. Then, you know, I remember giving a talk in Dublin a few years ago. And this, I think some of you will appreciate the story. So I was talking about the advantages of what sometimes the psychologists call the big five traits. You know, openness to experiences, conscientiousness, agreeableness, neuroticism, and so forth. Extroversion is another. And but then this person said, look, what you're trying to do is mold people. One of our great products in Ireland is Brendan Behan. What if he had been following? So the idea is we're imposing a Victorian mold on all children. And that's a danger. I don't think we want to. And that's the risk that comes. I mean, there really is, at least in the United States, a big division between the notion of what the family should do and what the state should do. And there's I remember giving a talk in Edinburgh about 10 years ago now, and I was talking about some aspect of early childhood programs. And I mentioned an adolescent mentoring program called Big Brother, Big Sister. And the headline in the newspaper the next day was, American economist advocates Big Brother. So, you know, Orwell, Shades of Orwell. But quite seriously, I think that in the U.S., when some of these legislation was put forward, people like Nixon, for example, this goes back many years. People say it's an old set of ideas. Vetoed it, partly because he thought this was the role of the family. This is the province of the family. But this gets to the other part of the political problem, which is understanding that families are not functioning so well these days, and especially in disadvantaged families. And that's a hot button issue in many areas. Nobody wants to talk about it in the United States. If you say that, you know, the Moynihan Report, which has been supported and resupported, and there's lots of evidence, that is not a politically correct thing to say in popular discussion. And yet it's a huge source of American social problems, and I suspect also British social problems. I remember this old article that Charles Murray wrote 20 years ago about the emerging underclass in Britain. He wrote in the Times. I mean, there is an issue that we do see these kind of class separations, and part of it has to do with family life. These programs are actually supplementing family life. And that, so it's dealing with a fundamentally different problem at a fundamentally different age, and we think about skill. So that's a long answer. So that's why I think it involves more than just changing the grades by 1 year. It involves kind of changing the ethos about how skills are created and what the demand is.
So we've run out of time, but I want to pin you down just on that last thing.
Sure.
This is fascinating. So, of course, improving quality also costs money, presumably require, for example, better teacher-to-pupil ratios to have that individualized attention. But is it your view that, in general, there's more bang for the buck in improving quality rather than extending quantity?
But I'll say it changes the nature of the changes.
If you have to choose where to put that extra education budget dollar.
I would say the best. I would give you the following example. It comes from Jamaica, which sounds like it's not at all relevant, but it's a curriculum that's actually being emulated around the world. Sally Grantham McGregor, who's here at the University College London, she's a very famous. Justly famous, I think, in her own world on and early interventions. She's run this shoestring programs, which have tremendous effects. What do? They take kids who are like 18 to 32 months of age. What are they training? These are all in very poor areas. In her initial study, in Kingston slums in Jamaica, but now in rural China, in, you know, rural Colombia and India and so forth. What you're finding is that interacting with the mother and a very low-cost intervention and teaching the mother to interact with the child, just making a coloring book, that has long-term effects, very low cost, long-term effects at last. So we published a paper together in Science a couple of years ago looking at the Jamaican program. The kids who had participated in the randomized trial, kids who participated in this followed 22 years later, those were much more likely to be employed, to have high wages, to have gone to college than not. That's a shoestring affair. So part of the question about what's meant by quality, I would still say it gets back to changing the nature of the parent-child relationship, to enriching it, supplementing it, and maybe, in her case, even directly intervening with it and just explaining to the mother. It's a good thing. So what does she do? She has coloring books. So the little kid will actually draw and say, oh, here's a bus. Mr. Jones is getting on the bus. Isn't that interesting? But when you interact that way, you're teaching the kid a whole variety of skills. You know, and then to say, okay, be patient with the child. Some very simple lessons, and it seems like that goes very far. That's a low-cost item. Now in the U.S., even in places in disadvantaged areas in the U.S., we're imitating that. There are high-end versions of these programs at like $25,000, $30,000 a year, and no way will they be replicated. Billionaires are paying for it partly as a, you know, it's one of their luxury fantasies. They can do it. But it's not going to go to scale anytime soon, $25,000 a year. But the McGregor program could be $700, $800 a year per child. But what I'm saying is it's an area that's explored. It's really, we're exploring it. It's under development, let me put it that way. So I think what we're learning is the key chemistries of the parent-child relationship. And the school can come along, or the preschool can come along and help foster that. But I think when we strip it down, we're just going to be enhancing parenting. And if there's no parenting, then we enhance it through a center or through having the kid, or we help educate the parent. It's that bringing the parent in. Parents are still pretty important. I mean, unless they're completely absent, never mind just the act of creation, but I mean in terms of the act of sustaining. Because they're still with the kid. I don't know how many hours a day the kid goes to school, 6, 7, even 8 hours a day, the parents are there, maybe just watching the kid sleep, but still there creating an environment. And I think that's what we've come to understand. But that, to me, is the biggest political barrier to discussing of this in many areas, to say the family is dysfunctional. And that's true around the world. I don't know the data in Britain, but I know that in the U.S. we have like 40% of all kids being born out of wedlock. And unfortunately, those kids, this is not Scandinavia. This is not talking about cohabiting arrangements, at least in the U.S. These generally are disadvantaged single parents, but the mother has less than a high school degree. Very low resources. And so you see this huge gradient, which is perpetuating itself over generations. And to me, it seems like this is a source of social ill, and it's a social cure if we actually tackle it. But you have to recognize it first. And that's what people don't want to do. And I'm not a politician, I can assure you, and I would never win an election if I tried to be.
But I think that recognition is where we have to wrap it up. We've kept you a bit past the time, but I think it was well worth keeping you because we've achieved something remarkable here today, I think, because you've been talking about this sort of view of education or skills provision as a sort of extended form of parenting.
Yes.
And there's, of course, this dividing line between the role of the state and the family in there. So I think we've achieved not just have a Chicago economist provide a free lunch, but see a Chicago economist come down on the slightly more statist line of that divide.
But it's a good Chicago line, And that is one of the foundations of modern macroeconomics is the so-called Arrow de Brou complete contingent markets claim. So if you take the complete contingent markets point of view to early childhood,
to the government.
Well, yes, but that what it means is the child, as a fetus, should be able to buy insurance against a bad parent. And so given that that market doesn't exist, then there's a very good argument for intervention.
So it's a completing market. Very good. Thank you very much.